about John at all, guys?
Only what you've told us.
Only what I told them. Oh, well,
was it good?
Yeah, it was.
I can redo my introduction.
Give them
he did a nice introduction last night, but we don't want to go over that again.
It's recorded.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah,
just a brief
you can listen
intro.
To it on
sure.
The
okay.
All right, so what I'd like to do is, and this first time, is talk about the some aspects of the family relationship, specifically on marriage, and then in the second one, to look at the family relationship in the body of Christ. This one is, again, it might jar you in a few points, but hang in there with me. And I'm just going to go through some aspects. And obviously, we have people in this room. We've been married 44 years. And I'm sure there's people here that aren't quite married yet. Who have been people who are a little older and aren't married yet. and then all that. So we have quite a bit of marriage experience in this room. So so it isn't like I'm talking to, people that are just about to get married or have only been married for a short time. But in any event, I do think there are some things that need to be we're never too far along, to consider some further things. And but I'd just like to share some things with you that are on my heart that come from, years of talking with people. And so actually the first place I'd like to start relates to something Mike said last night about the whole concept of 1 Corinthians 11, where it mentions the word head, and which is a Greek word, kephale. And this is definitely, might be an area where maybe I believe there's a lot of misconceptions. So bear with me, because what I'm about to say may be new to you, but I'm not asking you to believe me pontificating on anything, but there, if you do some research on your own, I think you'll find that the fundamentals that I'm going to say will be validated. And there's one particular article on the internet that I don't have the exact URL right in my mind, but I can give it to you. But it's an extensive article on kephale that goes into the classical usage of it, the New Testament, and everything. It doesn't leave any stone unturned. And you can check that out yourself. But what I would like to say is this, that it seems to me that there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the word head and how male headship has been used as a concept. And I would suggest to you that the word head, as it is used in the Greek language, has nothing, absolutely nothing, to do with authority over. Male headship does not mean authority over the wife. That is something that has come from different reasons and traditions and all that. But in terms of how the word is used, and I'm going to give you some suggestions about it. First of all, in the first century, the word head had nothing to do with decision making. We may view the head as being the seat of decision making or something, but that is not how they thought in the first century. So when they heard the word head, they did not think decision making. They did not think authority over. It was not an authority word. The viscera was the decision-making connection that they had in the first century. It was the viscera that was viewed as the decision-making seat, if you will. So the word head is used, of course, in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures. And the word is used about 180 times in the Septuagint. And it's mostly used of the literal head, just a human head. It's not used metaphorically very much. But interestingly, the word head in the Septuagint is not used with reference to kings, princes, or people in authority. So the Hebrew experts who translated the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek did not use kephale as a word connected to authority. That's a fact. And again, there always may be a few exceptions, which, you know how language is. You can't ever say a word is never used like this, because you'll probably find an exception. But I'm just saying that generally speaking, it was not an authority word, and it was not connected to people like kings and princes and all who were in authority. The word, on the other hand, does seem to be related to origin and source. So even in our language, we talk about headwaters. The headwaters would be where a river starts. And the Mississippi starts up in northern Minnesota. And so that's where the head of the Mississippi River is. Head has, obviously, in terms of Adam and Eve, Eve came out of Adam. Adam was her source. She came from him. And then likewise, the body of Christ comes from Christ. We come out of his side, as it were. So he is our source. He is the vine. We are the branches. So the thing that happens in linguistically and conceptually is that if people think that head means authority over, that can become very militaristic, as it were, very much like chain of command, and there can be very little relational thought. But when you see head as origin or a source, that's relational. Vine and branches is relational. So I think that we need to readjust our thinking, because so much of many books on marriage and all, they talk about male headship, and the way they talk about it, will vary, of course, but often they talk about, that the decision-making will be done by the husband, and the wife is supposed to submit to whatever the husband decides and all that kind of stuff. So I really think that needs a second look, because to me, I can't find that validated in the New Testament, for the reasons I've already given you, and there are many more. But I think if you view, when we look at 1 Corinthians 11, we're told there that the head of Christ is God, and that the head of the woman, the wife, is the husband. And I mentioned last night that that appears to be referring to the marital relationship only. It's not referring to men and women generically, but it's referring to the marriage relationship specifically in 1 Corinthians 11. Otherwise, you'd be saying that all men in the world are the head over all women in the world, whatever that may mean. And that I don't think that's what Paul has in view. He's talking about marriage relationships. So if you see head as source or origin, again, that can make some sense in that passage. If you say that head means authority over, then what would that mean for Christ and the Father? How would that relate? If it means origin or source, does that make some sense? So the head being of the man, and the headship of the man that's mentioned there, if that means origin or source, he mentions right in the next verses that the woman came from the man. That's what he says. And I would like you to turn to 1 Corinthians 11, because I do think there's something that gets lost in the shuffle there in the discussion. Because after Paul says that, verse 3 of 1 Corinthians 11, but I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every husband, and the husband is the head of the wife, and God is the head of Christ. then he works his way through his argument there, and he mentions obviously he's talking about something about head covering, and then he says, verse 8, "For man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed the man was not created for the woman's sake, but the woman for the man's sake. Therefore the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels." Okay, so people have obviously quoted some of these verses here for their reasons. But notice verse 11, that gets missed. What is Paul's conclusion? Where does he land? "However, in the Lord, neither is woman independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as the woman originates from the man, so also the man has his birth through the woman. And all things originate from God." So I think it's very important to realize that wherever Paul has said previously, verse 11 is his bottom line. That's where he ends up. In the Lord, there is interdependence of the husband and the wife. That's Paul's conclusion. You can't get around that. However, in the Lord. So the bottom line is Paul comes to interdependence of the man and the husband and the wife. And again, to read into the concept of head, meaning authority over, to me is not warranted from the text itself. That's not what Paul is talking about. But we can talk about that later if you have questions, but that's all I'm going to say on that right now. But I do feel that verse 11 is a conclusion of Paul's, and we need to take that conclusion in light of everything else that was said, and not forget where Paul ends up, because I think people just act like that verse doesn't exist, because interdependency is where Paul lands. Now, in light of that, look over at 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul talks about the marriage relationship a bit. And he says, now concerning the things about which you wrote, so in other words, Paul had some communication from them, "it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement or mutual consent, for a time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and come back together again, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control." So here we have some response to the Corinthian inquiry, and this is the only place in Scripture where the word authority is used in connection with the marital relationship. But notice that there's nothing about the authority being the husband over the wife. It's a mutual authority. They each have authority over each other's body. And Paul says that they are not to separate from one another physically without mutual consent. And the Greek word there is symphonou, from which we get our word symphony. And so the husband and the wife, if they're considering separating from each other for a period of time, like if the man is traveling to Turkey or something to go do some labor or something, that is supposed to be done with in mutual consent. And that raises a question to me. If something is as important as a husband and wife separating from each other physically for a period of time is to be done by mutual consent, what does that tell us about decision making generally in the marriage relationship? Now, the way many people talk about the husband having authority over the wife, how would you get that out of this passage? There's nothing about that. It doesn't say that the man can just say, "I'm leaving for 3 months to go work in Turkey." That would not be right, according to what Paul is saying. There's supposed to be a mutual, a symphony in the matter. not a unilateral declaration by either the wife or the husband. Why? Because they have mutual authority over each other's body. So the authority here is mutual, just as in 1 Corinthians 11, however, in the Lord, there's interdependence of the husband and the wife. So it's the same basic conclusion here and in 1 Corinthians 11. It's a mutual interdependence with one another, not the idea of somebody having authority over another person. Now, if you go to the Old Testament, I just wanted to mention a passage there that Dottie and I found interesting several years ago regarding Samson's parents. And here you have an example, and of course, with all that's in the Old and New Testament, as usual, you know, you can't put God in a box. You can't say that this is the way things are always going to happen. And obviously, Jesus didn't heal people in the same way every time. He had numerous ways that he healed people, for example. But anyway, in this passage, you have the husband and wife who are going to bear Samson. And so the angel of the Lord doesn't appear to the husband, but he appears to the wife. And he gives information to the wife, and the wife tells the husband, and then the husband says, well, let's ask this, you know, angel to return, or, you know, whatever, and confirm all this. And so the angel comes back, but again, he doesn't appear to the husband, he appears to the wife.
But she's not even pregnant yet.
No, no.
That's Judges 13, right?
Yep, Judges 13. Let's pick up in verse 9. And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of the Lord came again to the woman as she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So the woman ran quickly and told her husband, behold, the man who came the other day has appeared to me. Then Manoah arose and followed his wife, and when he came to the man, he said to him, are you the man who spoke to the woman? And he said, I am. And Manoah said, now when your words come to pass, what shall the boy's mode of life and his vocation be? And the angel of the Lord said, let the woman pay attention to all that I said. She should not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. Let her observe all that I have commanded. Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please let us detain you so that we may prepare a kid for you. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to the Lord. For Manoah did not know that it was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name, so that when your words come to pass, we may honor you? But the angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful? So Manoah took the kid with the grain offering and offered it on the rock to the Lord, and he performed wonders while Manoah and his wife looked on. For it came about when the flame went up from the altar toward heaven that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. Now the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah or his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. So Manoah said to his wife, we will surely die, for we have seen God. But his wife said to him, if the Lord had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have showed us all these things, nor would he have let us hear these things like this at this time. Then the woman gave birth to a son and named him Samson. And the child grew up and the Lord blessed him. So my main point in the story is just the idea that Dottie and I know one particular gentleman who teaches that the Lord will always show his will through the husband. And he's very dogmatic about that. But here's an example of where the Lord appeared twice to the woman, the wife. And, of course, the husband was involved. But the point is, the Lord didn't go through the husband. He went through the wife. That was his vehicle, his initial vehicle. So I just give it as an example to show that, to me, in light of 1 Corinthians 7, the issue is not if the couple is seeking the will of God. It doesn't make any difference whether the revelation comes from the wife or the husband, because they're seeking his will. And what difference does it make whether the wife has the right perspective or the man? The point is they want his will, and when he reveals his will, then the source of his will is irrelevant. It's not gender-based. And I think that's a very important point, because many couples, I think, get hung up on that. The point is, if we're seeking the will of the Lord together, then we have reason to believe that he will give us peace and give us mutuality, give us symphony in our decision-making together. Now, we have enough years of marriage in this room that I probably can be assured that every couple could say that in their decision-making times of decisions that are, you know, important, have some relevance, that probably sometimes the husband has deferred to what the wife discerned, and then other times the wife has deferred to the husband and what he discerned. That's probably happened both ways. So again, what difference does it make? The will of the Lord isn't just to come through the man or just through the woman. It's probably going to be a mutual thing over years of a relationship. The point is, they should both want the will of the Lord. What difference does it make whose mouth is the source of the answer, if you will? And I think that's the beauty of a mutual relationship, where you have seeking him together and not doing things without symphony. And I think, and again, in any marriage, there'll probably be times when maybe neither the man nor the wife can really discern what the mind of the Lord might be on something. So there might be cases where you wait longer and you don't make a decision. Sometimes you have to make a decision. So there may be cases where you defer to, again, either way. It could go either way. But the point is, the Lord is going to be with you if you're seeking him together. And that, to me, seems to be a model, if you will, or a way of pursuing togetherness that is truly letting the Lord reveal himself to the couple. And the specific sources of the will of the Lord is really irrelevant. The point is, the couple should want symphony together rather than just you might say, somebody unilaterally making a decision when the other one has no peace about it or whatever. I'm sure, again, all of us could testify that there have been times when we made decisions where we didn't have peace, and it may have come back to haunt us because we, you know, acted in a maybe a premature way or a pressured way or something. But again, the Lord is merciful in those cases too. But I'm sure we've all had cases where decision-making may be derailed in certain ways, and maybe the man or the woman would confess that they pushed too quickly, they didn't wait, they didn't listen, you know, and things like that. So these are all matters that take time and sensitivity to the Lord. I think I'll stop there for now. I have, you know, a little more to say, but with those passages that I've looked at, I probably maybe stirred up some questions or comments that you would like to make. So fire away.
And did you guys we were just kind of jumping right into the middle of it. I don't know if you caught where we were going with all this. We were basically saying husbands and wives are equal. And because you'll see in a lot of, not only in a lot of Christianity, but in a lot of other religions, they basically say the man makes all the decisions and the woman has to go along with it. But Jesus didn't teach that.
Okay. Karen let me borrow a book a little while ago. What was it? It was I Married You. I probably should return it.
Walter Trobisch. It's a book my parents gave, and it's been translated into something really good.
Yeah.
Oh.
It was pretty good about, was he a speaker or a pastor that went to Africa and talked on the subject to African people in Africa who believed, you know, that had different views on marriages.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
definitely male prominent.
Well, I have to ask then, you know, Ephesians 5. So, I mean, I'm fine with what you're saying. I'm not, not agreeing with it. So how does that reconcile
right.
with Ephesians 5?
Well, yeah, that would be the next place I was going.
Yeah, right. I'm sure.
Right.
No, I think it was a natural.
Right, yep. Mm-hmm. So we can forge ahead, but if anybody has any other questions or comments on what we've discussed so far, that's fine. But obviously we need to look at Ephesians 5.
It seems, and I'm not sure either totally, that I believe we are interdependent and equal before Christ, but that a role, it comprises a different responsibility. I think there are distinctive responsibilities in the husband's role versus the wife's role, but they're not an equal in essence before Christ. And servant leadership is how I view the husband's role. And there are times where we have to work out yielding to one another, depending on things.
But don't you think that it would be true to say that many evangelical couples sort of assume that in all of this that mm-hmm. that there's some kind of authority over the man that over the woman that it obtains to the husband?
I would say that comes through a lot. Yeah.
So all I'm saying is that aspect of it, okay. I think needs to be revisited because that to me misses some of the other perspectives that were in the 1 Corinthians 7 and 1 Corinthians 11. So that's, I mean, we'll look at the Ephesians 5 passage, but yeah, so yeah, there's definitely a lot to be said. Right, so.
What do you think it means to have authority over each other's body?
Well, in that setting, the main point would just be that for either of them to unilaterally say, I'm separating from you for a period of time, would be incorrect. In other words, because there's that mutual authority over each other's body, then symphony is the correct option.
But why would you say it? Is that just a euphemism? Or an idiom, I mean? Body? Authority over the body rather than authority over your mind or your emotions?
Well, he is specifically has the sexual dimension in view, so it appears to involve bodies. So I'm sure I agree with you. There's probably more involved. He's not just talking about, you know, the body. But I mean, the point is that for either of them to act independently without the symphony of the other is the problem. And the reason is because they have already, foundationally, a mutual authority over each other's body. In other words, the two have become one. And because they're one, then that would imply the need for symphony rather than independent activity.
I met a young man, he's not a believer, but some of this would kind of apply, in the Philippines. And he was going to let his girlfriend or wife, I can't remember if they were married or not, go to another country and earn some bread and butter kind of thing. And then she would come back and funnel all the money back. And this does happen.
Very common.
And yeah,
send
it does.
Money back to their home.
Right. And my friend Mulong was along with me, and it was really cool because Mulong said, you know, that may sound really good on paper, but he said something like 90 or higher percent of the ones that go abroad, whether it be the male or the female, end up in some immoral kind of sexual relationship. They either end up leaving their husband or wife for the wealth that could come across their plate, and the temptation of not being together. I mean, because we're talking like a year, and I'm not saying this could never happen, but it was so cool to hear Mulong come up with that, because he had studied it. He's Filipino, and so it's very common, like you also know in the Philippines, for one to leave, go to another country. Of course, a lot of times they're tricked and end up being sold, and so that's the end of them, gone. But if they end up in a legitimate job, which does not involve some kind of slavery, which would be kind of unusual, I would think, the temptation is just too great, and it ends up backfiring on them. So that's just kind of an example of what would happen to Christians. I mean, I could see it happening, and it would be really hard. But we have a friend, Marie and her husband, and he went to Afghanistan as a private contractor. They agreed that he would go, and he made a ton of money. And I'm sure she did, and I'm sure he did too. They stayed faithful to each other, but they made that commitment. They also weren't a young couple either. So it's not like, you know, a newly married couple. And this happens very, very often in the Philippines. It's the young people that are transferred abroad or you know, I mean, I know a lot.
Better life.
Yeah, and a lot of times it's not a better life. I mean, it's slavery, whether sexual or domestic slavery. But even if it wasn't where they ended up in slavery, it is not a good situation. The original family breaks up.
Now, I've always kind of interpreted 7 a little bit differently. I'm wondering where I'm making a mistake here.
I'll tell you.
Okay. That's just I thought I'd bring it up, and then you could tell me. Because in verse 5 it says, "Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourself to prayer." Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's not talking about separation in terms of physical separation, somebody leaving. It's talking about separation from sex.
It's
so, like,
for the purpose of prayer.
Right, for the purpose of prayer. So, mm-hmm. So mutually separating for your sexual desires, maybe for a couple of days, so you can devote yourself to prayer. Not, mm-hmm. not that that would exclude physically leaving.
Right.
But it seems like it's specifically talking about not separating sexually, except for mutual consent.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong about
that? That certainly fits the mm-hmm. context.
Right. Okay. Okay,
that would be like a could be seen as a particular of however of a general view perhaps. In other words, the mutual authority over each other's body obtains whether they separated for prayer or not.
Right.
They still have mutual authority over each other's body.
Well, I guess I say this from a certain amount of previous personal experience mm-hmm. in the sense that you know, you may not be separated physically, mm-hmm. but if be separated sexually mm-hmm. for a long period of time,
right,
and that can be incredibly devastating thing. So it seems to it's important that the idea is not necessarily physical separation. Mm-hmm. Seems like it's talking about sexual separation. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Well, but they would be. I mean, for a couple of days or whatever, they'd still. In some way be separated possibly for what the purpose of their devotion or whatever.
Right.
So
is the word depriving in there?
What is it here? I don't know if it's in the Greek.
It's in there. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's there. Yeah.
Well, it's preceded by the verse 2. It says, because of immoralities, let each man have his
right.
own wife.
Right.
Each
yeah.
one
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that automatically takes you into sexual context of
mm-hmm. Right.
So don't deprive each other of this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which physically separating would do.
Right.
I've read somewhere that the Israeli army won't send newlyweds into battle or separate them because of this sacredness of the marriage and mm-hmm. so forth in this mm-hmm. issue.
I wonder about deployment. Of course, we all know whether you're for military or not. The fact is, it does set up a really tenuous, mm-hmm. Fragile relationship. And I get prayer requests all the time for people who are separated because of prolonged physical separation.
Mm-hmm. And we know the statistics on that are not pretty.
Right. So, what a dilemma.
You know, I often wonder, though.
If, in fact, we have no here.
Well, I often wonder, though, it's like, did this couple make that decision for the husband to join the military? Was he in the military prior to their getting together? Well, sometimes, I mean, we've known, we actually know a couple that they got married specifically because, I mean, they were in love, they were living together, and he got paid more if he was married.
Yeah.
So they got married. Like, I mean, sometimes I think that the decision to go into the military is not a mutual thing at all. That
right there is the first.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so sure sometimes how much they really talk and think, and you know, is this really good for our marriage? Is our marriage so important that I'm going to forgo? You know, I don't want to go in the military, but do they really
weigh out
think about it?
Yeah,
you know, is it really healthy for their marriage for them to do this? And if he was in the military ahead of time, you know, did they really talk about what this was going to mean?
Yeah, and realize how heavy it would be.
You know, is the... Because sometimes I think people get just kind of selfish about, you know, I want to do this, and if you want me, you're going to follow along with it, and it's not a real healthy situation. And I don't think it's healthy for couples to be separated that long at all. And you know, how did this all come about? That's what I'm saying. I mean, everything is
right.
Every situation is not the same. But I sometimes wonder.
Well, I can speak from experience. My oldest son, who was in the Marines, married a young gal after 3 years in being a Marine. And she wanted to be a military wife. That would be exciting. They had four girls who married 7 years. His second deployment to Iraq, she decided it was now her time. Wow. So she's now a meth addict and making porno movies.
Oh, jeez, man.
So.
And what has he done? What has he chosen to do?
When he couldn't get back together, he excused the unfaithfulness while he was gone, but when she got into drugs and it was obvious he couldn't make it work, for the sake of the girls, he got a divorce. And he now has custody of them, and living in Spokane, got out after 12 years and being a gunnery sergeant, so tank commander.
He didn't just get custody of the girls off. That was a...
That was a three-year battle, and $1,000 out of my pocket later. But
thank God he's gone.
Right.
But
it was an ordeal, and you know, just the girls were in a lot of harm.
Yeah.
Bad, very bad situation.
Even though people consent, that if they don't know what they're consenting to, perhaps.
She thought it would be fun.
Yeah.
She didn't know, but she has a lot of past we didn't know about. Her father came and testified at the trial against his daughter for our son.
Oh my goodness.
He had gone through the exact same thing with the mother.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sins of the mothers fell on her. But what was interesting, it's real sad, is out of his unit, 29 Palms, they've been on three deployments, 90% of the guys have been divorced or separated. Some have simply separated, women go off and do whatever they want, but because they don't want to go through the hassle of divorce and there are any kids involved, they just separate. Because he's bringing the money and she just does what she wants. 90%.
It's like you want to say no marriage. Mm-hmm.
And they don't, in the Army, it's a year, 18-month deployment. They only had 9-month deployments. But it was one right after the other. So he'd be, would have been in Iraq three times and he'd probably be in Afghanistan right now, but
guys, they grow to love it. I mean, they have a strong comradeship. And a lot of
yeah.
Like.
The war part he didn't like. But
yeah, yeah, uh-huh. Exactly. I have a son, too.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So,
the military part.
I had no idea.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an income for many. They have very good income.
Well, if you're married, so, they can pay.
This backs up the separation is an issue.
But you're right. A lot of the guys, most of the guys that he in his company were married after they had already, they didn't go in married. Mm-hmm. They were married afterwards, and it's just, where's the world right now?
Yes. Yes. How old are the girls?
The oldest is here is 11, and the youngest is 6.
Is he a believer?
Yes.
That's wonderful.
They all went to believers.
That is really.
And we thought she was too.
Sure.
She did. And she did great for 7 years. Mm-hmm.
That's I bet she had quite a history that had not come out.
Yeah, we didn't know anything about it before we got married. We knew she had been in a boarding school. Her dad had sent her to a boarding school. It was a Christian boarding school, and she was saved. Because the group home wanted to take her. We found out later, but. But there she supposedly became a Christian. I mean, only God knows her heart, but.
Sometimes people get way off track.
Yeah, and turned her life around, and everything was fine until her mother finally straightened up her life after the next to the youngest girl was born and got back into her life. Into drugs and everything else.
Sounds like he's carrying on steadily.
Yeah, he's doing good.
He's pressing on.
That's where my wife is. Spring break, so she's over.
Good for her.
Taking her granddaughters.
So, Ephesians 5. Mm-hmm. Look at that.
Did it.
Again, there's a lot to say here, but keep in mind, you know, some of the things I've already said, because obviously they're part of the picture here, too. But anyway, something that's lost in the mix often is that there is, of course, to everything a context, and when you have in this context, you have an imperative in verse 18 of Ephesians 5 to not be drunk with wine, for that is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. And then Paul gives five participles that it would be indicative of the filling of the Spirit. So he has speaking to one another, and giving thanks and all that. And the last participle is in verse 21, and being submissive to one another in the fear of Christ. So we need to understand that in the context, Paul is talking about the outflowing of the Spirit in our lives. And here are five ways that that happens. And the last one is mutual submission of everyone in the body of Christ. All of us being submissive to one another in the fear of Christ. And only after he says that does he then move in specifically to wives and children and employers and employees. So verse 22 literally in the Greek reads, "Wives, be to your own husbands as to the Lord." There is no verb in verse 22.
So no submit?
Yeah. No submit. So where do you get it?
Implied by the parts.
You get it from verse 21. So that shows you that there's an intimate connection between verse 21 and 22. You would not know what wives were to do unless you had the mutual perspective of verse 21, which precedes, where the participle submitting to one another is used. So you have to supply that. In this version, the New American Standard, the be subject is in italics, which means that they're supplying it. It's not there. So, wives, be submissive to your own husbands as to the Lord. So all I'm suggesting is that I'm not suggesting that submission is the wrong translation or anything. It's right. But the point is that you would not know what that was without verse 21, which shows you that there's an intimate connection between the imperative to be filled with the Spirit, the five participles that are manifestations of the filling of the Spirit, and then moving into the specific relationships that Paul is going to talk about in the upcoming verses. So, and now I've already suggested when it says in verse 23, the husband is the head of the wife, I've already suggested to you that we should not read into that authority over. It means that the husband is the source of the wife, the origin, just as the Lord is the source or origin of the church. He is the source. We are the vine. We are the branches. He is the vine. So again, it puts it into a relational dimension, not a military direction. It's a relational dimension. So yes, wives are to submit to their husbands as to the Lord. Yes, absolutely. But keep in mind that verse 21 starts with the responsibility of all of us, which would include husbands and wives, to submit to one another in the fear of Christ. That's the starting point. Then he goes only into the specific areas he's going to talk about in the upcoming verses. And of course, it's obvious to say that most of what is said between verses 22 and 33 relate to the husband. Most of his words are directed to the husband, not to the wife. The wife is mentioned at the beginning and the end, but in between, he has all these words related to the husband. It's possible that this is the case because in the first century, you know, generally women were viewed as property, and it's very possible that Paul is giving these Ephesian husbands, look, your wife is to be cherished and nourished. She's not a slave. She's not a pawn in your game. So in any event, just keep in mind, too, that most of what Paul says here about marriage is directed toward the husband. And again, nothing that he says to husbands implies that they are like the taskmaster over the wife. They're very endearing, loving, relational things that the husband is to be to his wife. Basically, he's supposed to lay down his life for his wife just as Christ laid down his life for the church. That would be the essence of what he's getting at.
Don't forget that.
Right. I'm constantly reminded of that.
I just a question now. If this husband is cherishing and loving and caring for, you know, his wife, mm-hmm. and if she was his focus, he would never ask her to do something that wasn't in her best interest. Mm-hmm. So if you were to take this the way, you know, the wife submitting, it would not be so much of a problem because,
right.
Again, she's not going to submit to something that she doesn't agree with. Hopefully she trusts this man that she understands that her interest is foremost in his mind. So mm-hmm. it's like an interdependence mm-hmm. anyway, mm-hmm. She's the focus no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets the best part anyway.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Make him snap to it.
I've never heard this before, but and I'm not arguing with it. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that the way I've understood this is in the past is this isn't such a bad deal
mm-hmm.
because the wife is coming first.
He's being
benefited.
Always anyway.
Right.
And I mean, whether you can actually do that or not, that's another story. But you know, the wife really has a pretty good deal.
That's the key. That's the key.
I would suggest that if, in fact, the husband does serve his wife in a loving way, that she might actually need to be reminded to submit to him in this mutual sense, because it would be very easy, if all he's going to do is lay down his life, it would be very easy for her then to take control of the relationship. And so I think perhaps she needs to submit, not because he is lording over her, but because he's serving her. And it would be difficult for her to respect that, which is the second word. Right. To submit and respect, these are two things would be difficult if a husband is truly the servant in a household. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you submit to your slave? And if the husband is being a slave, then she needs the admonition. Mm-hmm. As a possibility.
Mm-hmm. I guess I've looked at, I mean, the way I've understood it, whether it's, you know, the way it's written or not, it's like, well, you're always thinking of each other first, mm-hmm. so that the mutual wife submission. Would always be thinking of her husband first, and he would be thinking of her first. So it's a mutual thing that if that's how it really worked, you wouldn't have to worry about, you know, abuse. You wouldn't have to worry about the wife wouldn't be concerned about submitting, if we're going to use that word, because she would trust that her best interest is what he's thinking about. I understand what you're saying. I guess I never thought about it as the husband being in a servant role. I guess I've always thought of him as being equal.
Right. Well, so I guess I'm thinking, here I am, I'm trying to put myself a little bit more first century. I'm thinking about where a woman is property,
yeah.
And she's used to being told everything to do, jump how high, all these kind of things. And now the husband is being instructed to reverse his role and become the servant. And that she might be inclined to say, all right, you know, I'm going to take advantage of this after a lifetime of the other. And so she needs to be specifically instructed to also be a servant, because her sense of freedom that she would at that point suddenly have after a reversal of her culture may tempt her to kind of be a usurper or something like that. And therefore she needs to be reminded, no, this is mutual.
Now, the person, the wife taking advantage of the situation, that doesn't sound like a first century wife. That sounds like a
now century
wife.
I think perhaps that's the reason the text is important to all of us.
Yeah.
But
one thing I would add to what you're saying, though, is that you're kind of creating a scenario whereas submission appears to be very mutual because she realizes how good she's got it. But you're always kind of holding in the back here. But ultimately, in any time of an impasse, yeah, I've got final say, and it never becomes an issue until there's an impasse. And I know that, you know, church leadership and hierarchical kind of situations like to retain that same type of authority, and that authority or abuse of authority never becomes an issue until there's an impasse. Because as long as there's consensus and everybody's going along, you never notice it, because they keep telling you, we're only doing this for your good, or I'm from the government, I'm here to help you. You know, but when there's a problem, and then they pull out the authority card, and I think that we as husbands need to realize that we don't have that card. We don't have that card to pull, because we always have to remain in this servant role. That is all we have.
Well, but
verse
23. I mean, I wonder what kind of. I'm trying to think of the impasse that would be so great that both sides would dig in and there's just no compromise.
Oh, that happens all the time.
That's
you
the
believe
rule
in
most
of your wife doesn't believe in spanking. Yeah, no, you have to have it. You have to do this together to do it right. Or you have to how you raise your children and discipline your children. You know, that you can't do it. You can't have mom do one thing and dad do another thing.
Agreed.
You have to do it together, right?
That's a good example.
So who's going to have the final say?
Dad for all
the
spanking.
What's that mean?
What?
Dad for the spanking.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have worked in our family.
Yeah.
One thing, too, about submission is that submission is voluntary. And there are so many cases I've heard over the years where in counseling or whatever, the husband will say something like, in telling his side of things, you know, he'll say like, I told her that our marriage would be better if she would just submit to me. Well, see, if a husband has to say that, then the battle's already lost. In other words, you don't demand submission from somebody. Submission is given. It's granted. And that puts it in a whole new perspective. But the point is, many men do demand submission in a way that it shows they have a problem. And they're missing something about the gospel in their marriage. But anyway, I'm just saying, once you put submission as a voluntary, we all voluntarily submit to one another. And that's what makes the oil of a wonderful family relationship in the body of Christ. But if the woman is voluntarily submitting, that's wonderful. But if she feels like she's got to, or the husband demands it, then the relationship is already soured.
Right, right.
For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church.
Mm-hmm. Is that the same word as before?
Is that figuratively speaking? Source.
Well, head doesn't mean authority over. Head means
source,
origin.
Mm-hmm. And Christ is the source of the church.
Right. Right? Mm-hmm. And it's relational. In other words, it's vine branches. It's not a over-under thing. It's a relational bond. Kind of a thing. Now, granted, of course, the church wants to obey Christ. So there is the idea of listening to the Lord, but you can't carry that to the extent that you would with a husband and wife. You couldn't. That would be impossible, because it would be autocratic. Then it would just be the man telling the wife what to do and everything, and that's not what's in view.
Therefore, as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get what you're saying, and I think you're spot on, actually, that we are truly equally mutually submissive. But there are, in our world, times where it's not that way, and then comes the working it out in a way that's ultimately going to honor the Lord. Think what we've really disagreed on that we have yet to go, man, we're at an impasse on this. We are on one thing, and it hasn't happened yet.
Two. Get the list.
And it has to do with retirement and so forth, but I am not at peace, and he's really wanting kind of this possible direction. It's like, oh my Lord,
mm-hmm.
He is too. So he's waiting on me, and I'm waiting on the Lord, and I...
Until we get that symphony, I ain't doing squat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a serious statement.
Right. Right. Well, that's good.
Right.
We're
all my witnesses
here.
Right.
Yeah.
Now we're going to get a fight. No, no, no.
But how is the church subject to Christ?
Yeah.
Well, obviously she listens to him in terms of the broad sense, when she wants to please him and follow him. Mm-hmm.
The only reason Christ, I think, has authority over the church is because he's building it.
Mm-hmm.
He's the builder. So.
That's interesting. When you say the church, what is the church? I mean...
Well, we'll talk about that in the next session. Not that I'll answer that question totally, but I mean, we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
The church universal.
Justin, Ethan, you guys got any questions?
Yeah.
Questions?
Whoa.
I was just just kind of like thinking.
You're listening in.
Mm-hmm. But I remember, just kind of a random point, sorry. I remember reading a book on like how cults kind of play marriage, and how even women want their husbands to be the master, so that way they feel taken care of, and so that's kind of why there's polygamy, because they feel, you know, this man can take care of me because he can take care of all of us and all our children and stuff. Anyway, and how they, anyway.
Yeah. So they're looking for. for safety and security.
Yeah. So it could be like
this.
Sometimes it is the woman looking for the man to be the authority.
I would agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if she has an authoritarian father.
I was going to say, where does it come from? What's the source of it?
It's interesting that the Hebrew word for husband is actually related to the word that we commonly associate with idolatry, which is Baal. And the Hebrew word for husband is Bailey, with an I on the end. So... So women can easily make an idol out of their husband, and that's, of course, we're talking post-fall, after the fall, and that's the problem where the wife can elevate her husband in an unhealthy way, and the man can be, you might say, persuaded or whatever by the charms of the woman in the wrong direction. So again, they both have to be careful about these things with each other and not manipulate and use each other or have unhealthy expectations of each other, but rather look at everything in light of the Lord. Because for a woman to look to a man to meet all her needs and be that, you know, the perfect husband and fix everything and all that, I mean, that's just not probably going to happen, you know, so you have to...
I think in today's society, too, you see the pendulum swing the other way, where women have become so independent, either out of their professional requirements or that you focus on, I can do things myself, I can get them done, and I can solve all the problems, I can fix all the things I need to fix, or because the husband splits and there's no one else in the picture, and you have kids to take care of, you are the family, but you also have to deal with that type of a relationship where it's hard to realize that there would be a partner that would look out of your interests as well, instead of the attitude of, I can do it myself. The society's become really complicated in different ways.
You know, a number of years working with high school kids, for the most part, I don't think they're really being taught, young men aren't being taught how to be men, and I don't think girls are being taught to be young women either. Mm-hmm. I think that it sort of happens, and the way the world is sort of shapes them and so forth, but, you know... I've had this conversation with boys, with young men, about being men, and some of them get it, but a lot of times they don't, and I don't think the girls help them at all. Yeah. So it's,
Our
culture is a mess.
Involved in that being a man, too, would be the idea of respecting women, and, you know, and that I think that's missing a lot. Respecting women, being part of being a man is to respect women. Well, to respect everybody, but to respect women.
Well, I think this role model thing culturally is what gets them all messed up because their role models are not great people.
Right.
You know, I completely agree with everything you just said about our culture. I think it's fair to say that Christianity is in opposition to all cultures. Because, I mean, if you can't go, for instance, over to Africa and find a better model of relationships. You know, for the vast majority of it, it's women are chattel. I mean, for the vast majority of those relationships there. And I don't think there's a good example in culture, any culture. I mean, there's some cultures that we might say are better. But whatever, Christianity is always the antithesis. It's always it's always a confrontive existence.
It's a counterculture.
Yeah, it's a counterculture.
Yeah, it's a good point. I never would have thought of it that way. But.
Yeah. So no matter what it is, what we're proposing in Christianity is against everything else.
It's upside down.
Mm-hmm. It's upside down.
It just seems though decent. You know, I mean, I can't imagine. I know you're going to make a joke about this, but I can't imagine, you know, abusing my wife. I knew that she did.
And he doesn't. He treats her like gold.
But you've been abused.
Well, you know.
Oh, the scales I can tell.
So, I, just being, you know, decent to each other seems to be, to me, the norm. And yeah, I've screwed up, but it wasn't that I, you know, that, you know, I was being malicious or, you know, ignorant is probably the word, but or naive maybe to be nicer. But, you know, it just seems that if people are decent to each other, that you don't run into so many of the problems.
Right.
But apparently that, again, if young people aren't being taught what's decent, then, you know, that argument just falls apart.
Right. Basically, people look at relationships as being used or manipulative, in other words, what can I get out of it? So that's a big break now and there. So no wonder so many relationships are bad. Because there's not a mutual respect. It's me and using you for some end.
Well, Seal is tired of hearing me say this, but take a look at commercials on TV, and I swear 80% the man is a dummy. It's the woman that is the smart one and corrects him on all these things. And TV shows, you know, married couples are kind of, they lie to each other, and they're, you know, and that's, you know, the interesting part, I guess.
That's reality TV.
Everyone loves Raymond. You know, I mean, so I have a real problem with that kind of stuff, where our culture is, you know, it just feeds into this, and it's like, this is normal? And no, it's not even close to being normal. But, you know, if that's what you're constantly fed.
I think it's kind of like, I think that actually is normal now, but normal doesn't mean right.
Wow.
So I think people have gotten to the point like normal, we're still trying to be normal, but everybody's trying to be normal, but no one's actually trying to fix the problems. So everybody's trying to be sexy because, everybody else is being sexy. Wear glasses and wear just clothes that cover up everything, well, everybody thinks, I'm weird. But why is she covering herself up?
Muslim.
What?
Genesis 3:16.
Oh, yeah, right.
Just to throw a monkey wrench, no.
That's
what I think part of the idea comes from.
Right. Well, of course, I can't really deal with that passage without at least jumping back to one in Genesis 1 and 2.
Yeah.
But, you know, before the fall, you know, you have, again, mutuality. There's nothing about Adam ruling over his wife in the garden, and the words are said to them, have dominion over the earth. It's plural, not singular, and Eve was still inside of him at that point. But after the fall, then you have sin affecting and actually creating a scenario where you would have gender wars, and so your desire shall be your husband, and he shall rule over you, and that is in the context, of course, of the words to the various parties, and ultimately the promise of the Messiah, who would come down the lineage of history and crush the head of Satan. And the way I would just put it bluntly is that to use Genesis 3:16 as a benchmark for Christian marriages it would be silly. In other words, you don't use the fall as a benchmark. Jesus went before the fall. When they asked him about divorce, he didn't go to Genesis 3:16. He went to Genesis 1 and 2. And said in the beginning, you know, it was like this. And it's only because of the hardness of your hearts that Moses allowed the divorce. So, you know, it seems to me that we need to use Jesus Christ as our benchmark. And if you want to go somewhere else, go to the pre-fall situation with Adam and Eve in that situation as a reference point. But Genesis 3:16 is just indicating that sin has affected male and female relationships, just like it affects everything else in the creation. And so that's what's going to be now. It's not prescriptive, it's descriptive of what's going to happen because of sin. And so basically the whole of the rest of history is mapped out right in those passages in terms of the Jesus seed crushing the seed of the evil one and all that. So I mean it's all there, but I don't think it's correct to use 3:16 as a, you know, here's our measuring stick as how men and women will function. I mean that doesn't seem correct to me. We ought to use the Lord Jesus redemption and the pre-fall situation with Adam and Eve, where they were functioning together as partners and there was no enmity between them at that point. And I always think of 2 of Genesis 5:2, where it says that, you know, he called them Adam. So there, the male and the female are called Adam. And so even the word Adam implies or is connected to the female. It isn't just male in that particular passage. So obviously Adam was carrying a woman, a bride in his side, and that bride was brought out just as we come out of the side of Jesus Christ, and he is our groom, and we are his bride. And that's the parallel between the two. And Paul says in Ephesians 5 that's a great mystery. I speak of Christ and the church. So that's really the bottom line about marriage, is that it's a type, a picture of Christ and the church. And that to me is a key for understanding a whole lot of things, because, you know, obviously there's a lot of talk in our day about same-sex marriage and different issues. But what I don't hear, frankly, folks, in all the culture wars about this, is that I don't hear about Jesus and the bride being the reference point. Why is adultery wrong? Adultery is wrong because Christ has one bride, and adultery contradicts that picture of Christ and his bride and the faithfulness there. Why is bestiality wrong? Why is homosexuality wrong? To me, you need to relate it to the final picture, which is Jesus and the church. That's why these things are wrong. And I think people often look at adultery like, oh, it's a violation of a commandment. Well, yeah, you can say that, but that's not really the ultimate point. It's a violation of Christ and the church. That's how God looks at it. God looks at everything in light of Christ. And I think we need to start looking at issues, social issues and all, in light of Christ, not just as issues, you know, because arguing about men marrying men and women marrying women, okay, but what's the real problem there? It does not fit with the picture of Christ and the bride. That's the real issue. And I think that gives us an opportunity to talk about that to people if those issues come up. What good does it do to say, I think same-sex marriage is wrong? Okay, fine. But if you relate it to Christ and the church, then you've brought in the real issue. And that gives some people, other people, something to think about, maybe. That's much more important than just saying you think something is wrong.
Which works if you have a biblical worldview, but if you don't, there's really no basis to bring a disagreement up.
Right.
It's tough because I wrote our governor.
It's kind of what 3:16 goes back to, is that that's a curse given to the fall, so we would expect that in the world, and that's what we see.
Right.
Men ruling over women.
Right.
Unless you're a Pacific Islander, so that's major.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Right.
But in Christianity, you throw that aside.
It's been reversed.
Yep.
But you still deal with the outcome of it in today's society, of course.
So why don't we stop here and we'll have our little munchy break or whatever, and we'll come back in a bit and look at the family of God.
Sounds good.